Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really big one, a foundational legal case in the U.S., Marbury v. Madison.
Yeah, absolutely foundational. Think of this as understanding a key moment that really shaped how American law actually works today.
And our goal here is to kind of break it down, you know, get the key facts, the main ruling, but in a way that's, well, accessible. No heavy legal jargon.
Exactly. You should come away understanding not just what happened, but really why it's such a big deal, why it still matters.
Okay, so let's set the scene a bit. We need to go back to the election of 1800. Super contentious, right? Between Adams and Jefferson.
Oh, yeah. A really tense time. Adams, the outgoing president, and his Federalist Party lost. Jefferson's Democratic Republicans were coming in.
But between the election and Jefferson actually taking office, Adams and the Federalists, they still controlled Congress for a short time. And they made a whole bunch of last-minute appointments.
These get called the Midnight Judges. It was partly because of the Judiciary Act of 1801.
Ah, right. That act. What was the main point of that?
Well, it created new courts, more judgeships. Adams saw it as a way to, let's say, keep some Federalist influence in the judiciary branch even after he was gone. Smart politics, maybe.
Definitely strategic.
Yeah.
And William Marbury, the guy this whole case is named after, he was one of these appointees, supposed to be a justice of the peace in D.C.
That's him, appointed for a 5-year term. Now, here's a really interesting wrinkle.
Go on.
The person whose job it was, as Secretary of State under Adams, to finalize and deliver these appointment documents, these commissions,
yeah,
none other than John Marshall.
Wait, the same John Marshall who then becomes Chief Justice and presides over this case?
The very same.
Yeah.
He was wearing two very important hats, basically back to back. Outgoing Secretary of State, incoming Chief Justice.
Wow. Okay. So what's the problem? Marbury got appointed. Right.
He did. Adams signed the commission. It got the official seal. But then time ran out. Marshall, as Secretary of State, didn't actually deliver all the commissions before Adams left office,
yeah,
including Marbury's.
Ah, so the paperwork wasn't physically handed over.
Exactly. And when Jefferson came in, he looked at these undelivered commissions and basically said, hold up.
He told his new Secretary of State, James Madison.
Right, that James Madison. He told him just to withhold them, don't deliver them. Jefferson's view was, roughly, if it wasn't delivered under Adams, it wasn't fully complete.
Okay, so Marbury feels cheated. He has this signed, sealed document somewhere, but Madison won't give it to him.
Precisely. And Marbury believes he has a legal right to that job. So what does he do? He doesn't start in a lower court.
No. Where does he go?
Straight to the Supreme Court.
Really? You can just do that?
Well, that's what he tried to do. He asked the Supreme Court for something called a writ of mandamus.
A writ of mandamus. What's that in plain English?
It's basically a court order telling a government official to do their job, perform a specific duty, in this case, telling Madison, hand over that commission.
Gotcha. So he's asking the highest court to force Madison's hand.
Yes. And he believed he could go directly there because of a law passed earlier, the Judiciary Act of 1789. He thought that act gave the Supreme Court the power to issue this kind of order in cases starting there. Original jurisdiction, it's called.
Okay, so the stage is set. Election turmoil, last-minute judges, undelivered papers, and Marbury knocking on the Supreme Court's door. Let's dig into the facts the court had to weigh.
Right, so Chief Justice Marshall and the court, they had to look at everything. The 1800 election, that tense transfer of power, it's all background context.
And the Judiciary Act of 1801 itself, creating Marbury's specific job.
Yes, that Justice of the Peace position in D.C., created by Congress, with a clear 5-year term, not just some vague promise.
And Marshall's own slightly awkward prior involvement as Secretary of State.
You can't ignore that, though the court's opinion doesn't dwell on it heavily. The key legal fact they established was when Marbury's right to the office became official.
When was that?
They decided it was complete the moment President Adams signed the commission and the Secretary of State affixed the official seal. Delivery, they said, wasn't legally required for the appointment itself to be valid.
Okay, so legally, Marbury had the job, even if he didn't have the piece of paper in his hand.
That's what the court concluded. He had a vested legal right to the office for 5 years.
So this brings us to the big questions Marshall had to answer, right?
Exactly. Marshall cleverly broke it down into 3 questions. First, did Marbury actually have a legal right to the commission?
And the court said.
Yes. Based on the signing and sealing, the right was established.
Okay. Question 2.
If he has a right, and that right has been violated because Madison is withholding the commission, do the laws of the country provide him a remedy, a way to fix the wrong?
And the answer there, Feels like it should be yes.
It was. The court said, basically, yeah, for every violation of a legal right, there ought to be a legal remedy. Withholding the commission was a violation.
All right, so Marbury's looking good so far. He has a right, it was dilated, and there should be a fix. What's the third question?
Here's the twist.
Yeah.
Question three. If there is a remedy, is this specific remedy a writ of mandamus from the Supreme Court? Brought directly here, the correct one.
So is he in the right court asking for the right thing?
Precisely. And this is where it gets really interesting and, frankly, historic. Remember Marbury based his case on the Judiciary Act of 1789?
Yeah, he said that act allowed him to come straight to the Supreme Court for this.
Right. That act did seem to say the Supreme Court could issue writs of mandamus in cases under its original jurisdiction. But the Constitution itself, Article 3, specifically lists the only kinds of cases where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cases involving ambassadors or states.
And Marbury's case, suing the Secretary of State for a commission, wasn't on that list.
It was not on that very specific, very limited list in the Constitution.
So he's got a law passed by Congress, the Judiciary Act of 1789, saying one thing about the court's power.
And the Constitution, the fundamental law of the land, saying something different, something more limited, a direct conflict.
What happens when a law conflicts with the Constitution?
That was the multi-million dollar question. And Marshall, writing for a unanimous court, gave the landmark answer. He said, essentially, the Constitution is supreme. It's the ultimate law.
Okay, makes sense. Top of the legal food chain.
Exactly. And any ordinary law passed by Congress that goes against the Constitution is void. It's not actually law. It can't be enforced.
An act repugnant to the Constitution is void. I think that's the famous line.
That's the one. So applying that logic, that specific part of the Judiciary Act of 1789, the part that seemed to give the Supreme Court original jurisdiction to issue a writ of mandamus in Marbury's situation.
Yeah.
Marshall declared that part of the act unconstitutional because it tried to expand the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction beyond what the Constitution allowed.
Whoa. So the law Marbury was relying on was struck down, at least that part of it.
Correct. And because that law was invalid, the court had no constitutional authority to issue the writ of mandamus Marbury wanted, even though they agreed he had a right and deserved a remedy. He just came to the wrong court initially, asking for something the Constitution didn't allow that court to give him directly.
So Marbury loses. He doesn't get his commission from the Supreme Court.
And he doesn't. He lost the battle, you could say.
But won the war. Or at least the case established something much bigger.
Oh, absolutely. Much, much bigger. While Marbury walked away empty-handed, the case established the principle of judicial review.
Judicial review. Okay, let's unpack that. What does it mean, simply?
It means the Supreme Court has the power, and arguably the duty, to look at laws passed by Congress and actions taken by the president or the executive branch and determine if they are constitutional.
And if they're not.
If the court finds a law or an action conflicts with the Constitution, it can declare that law or action null and void. Unenforceable.
So the court gets the final say on what the Constitution means and whether the other branches are following it.
That's the core of it. It acts as a check on the power of Congress and the president, ensuring they operate within constitutional limits.
And this power, judicial review, it wasn't actually written out explicitly in the Constitution itself.
Nope. That's what makes Marbury so significant. The court, under Marshall, asserted this power for itself in this ruling. It interpreted its own role within the system of checks and balances.
And this is obviously stuck. It's fundamental now.
Completely. It's the bedrock of the Supreme Court's authority in many ways. Think about major cases throughout history. The court striking down segregation laws, ruling on presidential power, defining rights. That's judicial review in action.
Was it controversial at the time? Did people just accept it?
Oh, there was definitely debate. Some questioned Marshall's logic or whether the Constitution really intended the court to have such a, well, potent power over the elected branches. But over time, it's become a deeply ingrained, accepted feature of the American system.
Okay, so let's boil it down. The big takeaways from Marbury v. Madison for someone trying to understand the basics.
Two main things, really. One, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Nothing passed by Congress or done by the president can override it.
And two.
Two, it's the job of the judicial branch, specifically the Supreme Court, to interpret the Constitution and determine if the other branches have overstepped. That's judicial review.
And understanding those two points really gives you a crucial insight into how American government is structured, how power is checked and balanced.
Absolutely. It explains the unique role and, frankly, the power the Supreme Court holds.
So here's something to chew on, a final thought maybe. How different might the U.S. government be today if Marbury had gone the other way? If the court hadn't claimed the power of judicial review back in 1803?
Yeah, think about that. What if Congress could pass any law or the president take any action without the court being able to step in and say, hold on, does that violate the Constitution?
Right.
What would the checks and balances look like then? Positives, negatives.
Definitely a fascinating what if. If you want to explore this more, you could look into other cases where judicial review was critical, or even the ongoing debates today about how and when the court should use this power.
It's a topic with deep roots and continuing relevance.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Marbury v. Madison.
Hope it was helpful in clarifying this cornerstone case.